This is Val Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's been a good week. There has been some sadness this week. And unfortunate sadness. There's more than one unfortunate sadness this week. My buddy, Chris Hill, whom we have been praying for, died on Friday morning. I was a little bit hesitant as to how I should I should say this, but last Saturday, and mind you, Chris Hill had a great sense of humor. He could see humor in everything. So last Saturday, Chris Hill had died last Friday morning, so it would have been just 12, 15 hours after I'd done the podcast. Passed early in the morning, like 5 o'clock. And so Saturday, I was at a worship team thing, and I said to them, the situation with Chris Hill has been resolved, and I'm trying to find the gentle way of saying it, and, you know, so I said he went home on, Friday morning. And there was one lady there who was rejoicing because he was able to go home. And then I realized I had said that wrong. It's like Jesus when he's talking about Lazarus and his disciples. He said, we've got to go because Lazarus is asleep. And they say, well, if it's sleeping, if he's sleeping, he's good. And then Jesus says, look, he's dead. It's that. Oh, man. So it was one of those situations where I was like, no, he died. But like I said, I know Chris Hill. And Chris Hill, if he was actually listening to us at that point, he was laughing because, he was snorting and clapping and laughing. So, but there is sadness there. Might remember his family. But then this week also, I heard that another associate, Larry Quackenbush, who I had known, who was a recording engineer, he died, never got off the vent. There was a report in one of our news organizations here that was saying that half of the people in the ICU are dying now. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And maybe it would be better in some odd ways if there were no other treatments. We could all say, well, the medical community, the medical establishment is doing exactly the best job they can do. But there's too many people who are trying other treatments that are working well. And the medical establishment is just looking at it going, nope, we don't want to hear that, nope, la 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 la. I was just listening to a YouTube video about a serial entrepreneur who actually moved off responsibility for his businesses to other people so that he could pursue trying to find early treatments, put $1 million of his own money into it, and has had some good success with things like fluvoxamine or ivermectin, and yet this, nobody cares. And he was telling the story of a couple of doctors who tried a whole bunch of stuff together, a whole bunch of multi-drug treatment, and they've tried it in like 4,300 patients. One has gone to the hospital out of 4,300, and zero have died. And nobody seems to care about that. Our little newspaper here in town talked to a doctor. I didn't even read the article, but it says, Springfield doctor says you shouldn't use ivermectin. Oh, well, thanks. That'll change everybody's mind then. Never mind, there's been 60 studies around the world, a meta-analysis done, but it's just a Springfield doctor has said you shouldn't use that. Okay, great. It's just so sad. But on the flip side, what's going on with ivermectin and its ignorance by the medical community, or outright opposition by the medical community, is not new. This is not a new phenomenon. I was listening to a doctor on a related topic talking about sepsis and people showing up in the emergency room with sepsis, which will kill you fast, and how he and another doctor, I think it was he and another doctor, had discovered that, or had read about and then tried it themselves and it worked, that if you gave intravenous vitamin C, he was saying, you know, you can't really high dose vitamin C going through the digestive tract because just too much of it. But he said, you can do it intravenously. And he said, unexpectedly, they discovered that if people get it within 6 hours of presenting at the emergency room and you do high dose intravenous so many times a day, that you can actually keep those people from dying. And he said, you know, you would think that you publish this, show your results, and that people would go, hey, we'll try it. And yet, you know, the response is, no, that doesn't work. Even And then they quoted this philosopher or something about the three stages of truth. And, you know, when I heard the quote, I was like, yep, that's flesh for you. Yep. Because the three stages of truth are something like, well, the first thing that happens is it gets ridiculed. And then the second thing that happens is it gets violently opposed. And then the third thing that happens is it gets accepted as self-evident. Which is exactly, what we saw with the COVID lab leak hypothesis. First it was like, oh, you guys are just a bunch of conspiracies. You know, anybody who says that, you know, the next thing. And then now it's like, oh, of course, it's probably a belief. Oh, thank you. So, you know, we're in the middle of all this. And it's a little bit sad this week because I've had two associates now who have died because they've been put in the hospital, put on ventilators when they never should have been in the hospital in the first place, because there should have been an early treatment program. And then they were put on the ventilators, which apparently no drug regimen that could actually help them. And then they died. Now, Jesus knows about all these things, and obviously they've gone on to their reward, and they're much better off now than they were when they were here. But they leave behind children and wives, and, you know. I just this week had another associate who was diagnosed with COVID like last Friday, I think. Came back with a positive test. As soon as I got on Monday, I emailed him and, you know, went down the whole thing, ivermectin, blah, 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 blah. Well, he didn't actually sign on to his email account until yesterday. So he called me and we talked about it, and at least in his case, it was good. He did say, interestingly enough, that his daughter was taking, like, an ambulance, had called the ambulance so that she could get in faster. And it was some hospital they were going to, or something that they were going to in Kansas City, and they actually said, we're going to give you a dose of ivermectin. And that was kind of a surprise. But my associate that I was talking to yesterday, he told the story of his daughter was trying to get them a televisit because my associate was developing what felt like to him like bronchitis, which is in that coughing stage, you know, with COVID. And there was something about the fact that the administrators of the hospital were saying, no, you know, we don't need to talk to him. We don't need to see him. You know, it's fine. And she just kept pushing, got the doctor finally to do something. And then the doctor went ahead and prescribed the steroids and the antibacterial, you know, in case it develops into something else. So, I mean, this and I was talking to the young man who lives in our rock house, Dustin, and he said, that's just so crazy. He said, because anytime you get any kind of respiratory thing, you know, it's standard to say, fine, let's put you on some, you know, cortical steroids or something to help knock down the inflammation so that your body can recover. And yet with COVID, it's, yeah, no, just go home. We'll talk to you later. It's like, what in the world? But, you know, one of the things I was talking to my daughter about is when you look at this whole thing, when you look at the, starting all the way back in 2012, when Fauci wrote the article about gain of function research and how, yes, something may escape from the lab and potentially it might cause a pandemic, but it's still worth doing this research. Oh, right. I wonder how you feel about that now. Trillions of dollars, what, 6 million people have died. But when you see that failure and then the cascading failures where we managed to get the gain of function research stopped and then, you know, the health establishment goes ahead and says, no, let's go ahead and keep doing that. You know, I mean, oh man. You know, and now we are here in this, I mean, it's. And then you see the whole early testing thing where there was early testing starting up and then they decided, no, let's not do that anymore. And I mean, you know, just the whole bit. It's really fascinating. I'm getting my mail, by the way. That we've had so many failures. And I told my daughter what's really also very fascinating is that they all fail in the same direction. They all fail in the direction of making the pharmaceutical companies as much money as possible. Or I should say the medical establishment as much money as possible. But that isn't anything new, unfortunately. It's just nothing new. I mean, how many years did establishment like the tobacco industry make money and try to convince us that cigarettes weren't addictive? How much money did they make across all of that? And all the establishment went along with it and it was like, oh, yep, nope. I mean, how long have we gone thinking that overconsumption of sugar was no big deal? You know, I mean, you just see examples of this over and over and over and over again. And actually, by the way, writing's going good. Costumes are going good. Work is good. All is good. So, yeah, let's go ahead and do this. I think I've mentioned this in the past, but I don't know that I ever have done a podcast on it. I tried to look it up, and I didn't see that I had talked about this in the past. So we'll just go over this. And this, here again, is yet another example where there are failures all along the way, and they all seem to be failing in the direction of how do we make the most money from this. Abigail Schreier is a writer for the Wall Street Journal, does opinion pieces, that sort of things. She wrote a book which was named by The Economist as one of the most notable books of 2020. It's called Irreversible Damage. I'll be right back. Hold on a minute. I'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. So anyways, that was the UPS guy had just driven up, and I've had a chance to say hello to him a couple of times in the past. And so if I'm here and he's here, I like to go out and, you know, chat a little bit and see what there is to see. Anyway, so Abigail Schreier, she wrote a book called Irreversible Damage, The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. And she said she had done a piece on transgender pronoun laws that in New York and California, they're now assigning criminal and civil penalties for failing to use a person's preferred pronoun. And she said, I pointed out that these laws are straightforwardly unconstitutional in the United States. And she said, a reader wrote me and said, maybe you'll take up my issue. She said, I'm a mom. My daughter had no symptoms of gender dysphoria throughout her growing up. And then she went off to college and she had some mental health problems. And she went off to college with a group of girlfriends and they all decided that they were transgender. And she started on a course of testosterone. So, and that's, they go on to talk about how that there is a standard of affirmation now, a standard of standard of affirmation that if you just go to a counselor and say, well, I think I'm transgender, the counselor says, okay, well, let's get you on some drugs here and let's just do this. And a teenager can go and just, a teenage girl can just go in and say, I think I'm a transgender male, and they will just put her on a regimen of testosterone without even talking to her parents. And she said, there is this giant demographic jump in girls who as a population experienced very little gender dysphoria, if no gender dysphoria throughout history, and suddenly they're the leading demographic. And she said, I talked to experts and would say, what would you call this? And they said, we'd call that an epidemic. Because Abigail Schreier kind of equated this to like bulimia and anorexia and, you know, that these young women who are just fresh into puberty and, you know, they're dealing with all of these hormones and this sort of thing, that this demographic can be very easily swayed into mass movements where you've got all of them trying this stuff like anorexia and things. And, you know, there is in the short term, if you suddenly say, well, I'm a transgender male and they give you testosterone, then all that anxiety that you're feeling in the short term is alleviated. But there are long-term consequences for all that. And once you feel that in the short term being alleviated and say, oh, well, this is so much better, I guess I'll just go ahead and get my breasts cut off, which is what a lot of these young women then go ahead and do. And then a couple of years goes by and all of a sudden they realize that, you know, that was not the thing. And there's a whole bunch of detransitioners now who are on YouTube talking about this. So, and apparently they started talking. She was doing an interview with Jordan Peterson. And they started talking about Ken Zucker, I think his name. They said, you know, truly a giant in the field of gender dysphoria, and who actually oversaw the authoring of the definition of gender dysphoria, he was fired. You know, he occupied a very prestigious position in the world of transgender treatment and was universally regarded as the most outstanding and the most objective scientist working in the field. Dedicated clinician, et cetera, and he was just fired because he said, you know, we need to adopt a wait-and-see attitude. Because we don't want wait-and-see. We just want to go ahead and, you know what? You feel like you're a man. You feel like you're a woman. Let's just go ahead and get you on hormones. Let's get the surgeries done. Let's just shove this through. Failures. And they all fail in one direction. So I'm looking for a figure in here because there was, I mean, it was astonishing. There it is. So she was saying that the number of young women being referred for gender treatment has exploded over 4,000% in the last decade. I think that was in Britain. And she said, we don't have centralized medical care, and so we don't know the numbers here, but she said you don't even need a diagnosis of gender dysphoria to start treatment. You can start a course of testosterone without having ever received a diagnosis of gender dysphoria. She said in 2018, 2% of high school students said they were transgender. So that's two kids in 100. She said historically the rate of gender dysphoria in the population has been 0.01%. 1 in 10,000. So this whole thing has just exploded. And of course, Jordan Peterson was talking about, well, why do you think people don't want to talk out about this? And what was interesting is that Jordan Peterson actually said at the top of the interview, he said, I must tell you, I was concerned about whether or not I should interview you. And she said, look, if Jordan Peterson is concerned about whether he should even talk about this topic because of the potential blowback, she said, what do you think about people that don't have nearly your courage with all the things you've done? And Jim, it's just... So, and they talk about in this that some people will say, well, there's always been more transgender people in the population, but there was such a stigma attached to it that that's the reason that we're seeing this huge jump all of a sudden. And her response, I thought, was very good. She said, you would expect a large rise in transgender identification across populations if that was true. It wouldn't just be teenage girls. But you'd see women in their 40s and 50s and 60s, and you would see more men coming out as transgender in comparable rates. But that's not what you see. You're seeing this explosive rise in young women, teenagers, college age, explosive rise, and suddenly proclaiming that they're transgender. And the trouble is that first it's testosterone, then it's mastectomies. The testosterone atrophies uterine and vaginal tissue, and you make these irreversible changes in women's bodies. And it's not good. They also went on to talk about just kind of societal things. And it's just so sad across the board because you've got young men who are addicted to pornography, who are expecting intimate relationships to be one thing from everything they've seen. You've got young women looking at this pornography and the violence involved in it, and they're not interested in that. And taking testosterone is a way to kind of rewire themselves so that maybe they're not in, you know, don't have to be as that. And so you've got, we're not forming families. She said, I have interviewed many transgender adults who are flourishing. They're leading good lives and they're gainfully employed and they're happily and socially connected. She said, that's not a problem. She said, the reason these girls are the subject of my book is that they are not flourishing. They are not doing well. They are not connected to friends and families. They are not staying in school. And, yeah. And she said, the problem is, if you're an anxious teenage girl and you're given testosterone, at least in the short term, that can do wonders for your anxiety. Whether or not your mental health improves might depend very much on when you measure it. If so, you're anxious and your identity is chaotic, you take testosterone, and immediately you feel better, well, that's fine. But when you go down the road, when you get farther down the road, and things start getting masculinized, and her shoulders broaden, and her voice drops, you know, and her vagina atrophies, and her uterine atrophies, all of a sudden, there's an increased risk of endometrial cancer. And so doctors typically recommend at 5 years on testosterone that a prophylactic hysterectomy is performed. So, and that is, in other words, to prevent cancer, since you're on testosterone as a woman, then we'll just go ahead and take your uterus out and everything. I mean, this, it's just, wow. Wow. And then, you know, they talk about the surgeries. It was interesting because they were talking about the delicate surgeries of trying to actually build a penis, and how that is, if you're going to get any kind of satisfying performance at all, if you have to have a penis built for you, you have to have some very delicate neural surgery done on the end. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And most of these hospitals don't have that, but they just bring people in from whatever discipline they have, and they just do the operations because there's a lot of money to be made. So there has been at least one lawsuit, you know, where this young woman was just kind of railroaded through this whole process, and then when she got into her 20s, you know, she had deep regrets and stuff. And so she was in the process of suing to say, why didn't anybody just say, let's take a pause and let's have you think about this? And I mean, they're, they're talking about, you know, to build a penis, you got to get the skin and the fat from someone. So what they actually do is they de-sleeve the forearm, one of the forearms of the women, where they have to remove the fat and muscle from around the forearm, and that's what's used as the shaft. This is astonishing. I mean, it's just astonishing. It is every bit as astonishing as what's going on with COVID. All these failures, one right after another. Just rushing headlong into mad destruction. I mean, it's, but, you know, she said, I'm told, you know, I've interviewed a lot of surgeons, and I'm told that surgeons who do this very well and are very skilled at this, are very highly trained in this, can do a pretty impressive phalloplasty. But the problem, of course, is that these are big money makers, and for the hospital, there's a lot of pressure to do this surgery, and I keep hearing from surgeons that the people who are doing these surgeries are very often not qualified, and they're not qualified to transfer the nerves, and that each of these microsurgeries involves a different separate fellowship, and they haven't done those because the hospitals are so desperate to make this extra money, they're not putting the traditional safeguards they would normally do. And it doesn't take much imagination for someone who's undergone surgery or have witnessed someone who's undergone surgery to imagine just how complicated and difficult this is, especially to bring out anything approximating success. And yet, we apparently just keep doing these surgeries. What's happening here? Everything is failing in the same direction. It's all failing in the direction of how do we make as much money as possible. And of course, the underlying problem there is that we've abandoned a moral code. And we don't have a moral narrative that we're telling each other anymore about treat others as you wish to be treated, be kind, love your neighbor. And all that's left, once we're beyond that, is destruction and frustration. And I think I probably mentioned this already, but when the guy was talking about intravenous C, I think it's very revealing that not only, maybe I didn't mention that. Maybe I got distracted. So he was saying that, sorry if I'm repeating myself. I haven't eaten anything for 2 days here. So sorry if I'm repeating. That there was another study that was done on intravenous C, and instead of giving the intravenous C to the people with sepsis, like 6 hours, within the first 6 hours of them being in the emergency room, they gave it like 18, 24 hours, and then it didn't work. And he said there were the glee in the reporting, like, see, we told you that wouldn't work, that won't work, ah, you know. But there again, that's just destruction. Why would you rejoice over something that didn't work when there had been some reports that it was working? Why didn't you, wouldn't you go back and you would look and say, okay, is there any differences here? Is there something we could, but no, it's just like, see, didn't work, you know. I was listening to another thing about fluvoxamine back on COVID. Fluvoxamine is another one of these drugs that really does seem to help in the early stages. It has to be in the early stages. And they were talking about that, yeah, there had been another study done, but they gave it late. And they're like, that doesn't work. Well, okay, but you gave it late as opposed to be early. It's like with ivermectin. You don't take it on an empty stomach. You have to take it. But all along the way, we see this situation where either intentionally or unintentionally, a study is crafted to show failure so that then we can say, see, that doesn't work. What you have to do is go get the vaccine. And it's all just flesh. It's all just flesh. Up and down, through and through. It's flesh. It's maximum destruction. It's maximum frustration. And it's not new. It's just not new. And the only hope that we've got for any of this, the only hope that we've got for any of this is for us to get some salt and light into this whole situation, you know, and get back to some sort of moral narrative, because all this tribalism, it ain't good. And it just is causing so much destruction. So, step at a time, moving forward. I'm going to keep putting on my little costumes and going to the Walmart and talking to the people. I had something cute happened. I mentioned it on my reaction video. Last week was International Mustard Day. And I got together with breakfast with a buddy on Saturday, and he came in and we were chatting. He said, you know, I got out of my car and there's a Jimmy John's restaurant right across the street from where we usually park our cars to go into Gailey's Breakfast Cafe. So I had gotten there a little early, got my stuff on, went into Gailey's Breakfast Cafe. Then my buddy came, parked right beside me, got out. Above Jimmy John's, there's some apartments up there, and there was a guy who lives in their apartments, and he said the guy who lives in the apartment over Jimmy John's actually called out, and he said, hey, he said, do you know that costume guy? And he said, well, actually, I do. I think he said, you mean Phil? And he said, yeah, actually, I do. He says, so why does he do that? Why does he wear all those costumes? And he said, well, he just, you know, it's a way for him to start conversations and to make friends and to make people smile. And he said, well, tell him it's working. So that was nice. That was nice. So I was supposed to have breakfast with a buddy on Tuesday. And I got there, got on my car. I was walking over. And I noticed there was a guy on the balcony in that apartment. And I got, you know, a couple of yards down. And I thought, you know what? I spun around and went back up. I said, how are you today, sir? He said, good. I said, I'm that crazy costume guy. Because, of course, he's not going to recognize me in regular clothes. He said, oh, hey. And so we just chit-chatted for a little bit and had a real nice time. And he said, well, I got to tell you, you always make me smile when I see those costumes. I said, good. I said, that's the point. Have a great day, sir. So I've made a new friend. We just need more of making new friends, and we just need more of being kind to each other, and we just need more of that. A lot more of that. Salt and light. Salt and light. We just got to realize that the stuff that's going on right now has been going on for a really long time, and the source of it is the flesh. The source of it is the world. The source of it is the devil. And I don't think we're really going to make much headway against it if we're just condemning and pointing fingers and being ugly. I think the only way we're really going to make any headway against this is to reestablish moral behavior, to reestablish kindness, generosity, love, patience, goodness, all those fruits of the Spirit to get us back on track. It's just going to be fascinating to see how this all works out. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.